Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor'ı dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumya Ektay, The Fifth Floor, Farnak Amidi Sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. The 29th of June will be 10 years since the group Islamic State, or IS, declared its self-styled caliphate.
Celebrating the caliphate. Jihadists in eastern Syria greet the announcement of a new khilafah. A strict Islamic caliphate stretching across the border with Iraq and ruled by the extremist group ISIS, now renamed the Islamic State. They've bulldozed their way through the border, merging the areas they've seized, areas now lost to the governments in Baghdad and Damascus.
IS was dominating headlines for years by committing attacks and atrocities, until after years of fighting against countries like Iraq, Syria, and the Kurds, it finally lost all of its territory in 2019. But losing their territory didn't mean that they were gone for good. The group still exists and is active in some parts of the world. Mina Alami works for the BBC Jihadist Monitoring Team. She investigates groups like IS, and she's joined me for this episode to tell us about how these kind of jihadist groups work and how they use media and propaganda to push their agenda and recruit people. Mina, hi, welcome to The Fifth Floor. When and why was BBC Jihadist Monitoring Team established?
So our team was set up in 2006. It was just a few years after 9/11 and a year after the London transport bombings, if you remember. So jihadist groups at that time and their followers had a growing presence on the internet. They were exploiting it to push their narratives. Most of these narratives, of course, were violent ones. So to us, it became clear that just as we need to understand the media as well as propaganda of various state actors in various countries, we also needed to understand the media landscape and messaging of jihadist groups. This expertise is essential, I think. Without it, we really risk either underestimating or exaggerating the jihadist threat or missing crucial context and nuances.
And Mina, when we're talking about jihad and jihadists, what does it actually mean in this context? Because I know it's one of those words that brings out a lot of conflicting arguments.
Absolutely. It does. I mean, the word itself in Arabic means struggle, as simple as that. And it could be spiritual struggle, like you're patient, you endure illness, and that's kind of a struggle, a jihad in itself. It could be verbal struggle, for example, when you speak out against injustice or oppression. But in this context, and how jihadist groups use it, is really the armed struggle.
The armed struggle for what?
They frame this in a context of holy war. Jihadists are holy warriors, and they are engaged in jihad or fight or struggle for the sake of God and to establish his rule on earth.
And to create a country that is ruled by Islam.
Absolutely. And it's really important that you mentioned that, because that is their end goal. And that is what they say repeatedly in the messaging, to establish a state or a caliphate, actually, that is ruled by Sharia, that doesn't submit to constitutions or man-made laws, that is ruled by God's rule, as they say.
And in 2014, the IS group, they declared their own caliphate. Tell us about that. What was happening? What was the context? I remember how, you know, images were flooding the media, and it was quite a worrying time for a lot of people, especially in the Middle East.
Yeah, it was. And also because it was such a kind of, it was a shock and a surprise, even to us jihadi watchers. Of course, we knew the rising threat and influence of IS, but not to the extent that it would have these lightning land grabs and declare a caliphate. In Iraq at the time, there was ongoing sectarian tensions between Sunnis and Shias, with many of the Sunni population accusing the Shia-led Iraqi government of oppressing and marginalizing them. Now, this provided fertile ground for IS to exploit. So when it came to Sunni-majority areas, it promised to restore Sunni supremacy, as it called it. So these areas fell quickly to the jihadists, to IS, especially as the government failed to put up a fight. Mm. Now, across the border in Syria, it was a similar situation, but there was a raging civil war, so it was even worse. The civil war pitted the government of Bashar al-Assad against the Sunni rebel groups, whose cause eventually was hijacked by the jihadists, by al-Qaeda, by IS. And IS eventually managed to overpower a lot of the rebel groups that held territory in Syria. Eventually, it linked up its areas that it captured in Iraq with Syria. And it made a big propaganda stand about, you know, we are demolishing the man-made borders. So they even had that very infamous video of the spokesman and one of their commanders on a bulldozer and actually literally bulldozing the dirt borders between Iraq and Syria. That was such a symbolic moment, and it really dazzled many Muslims, I guess, from across the world who went and joined IS.
And I think that context is so important, that what was going on in these countries that allowed for the IS to take power. There were jihadist groups before IS. You call yourself a jihadi watcher. I like that word. As a jihadi watcher, what was so special about IS that made them stand out?
You're absolutely right. There were, and there still are, multiple jihadist groups. And IS actually did come out of al-Qaeda. But I would say there are probably three main reasons that distinguished IS. First was the lightning land grabs across Syria and Iraq that made the world sit up and pay attention. What is this group that managed to swiftly take control of areas in Iraq and Syria, join them up? So that was the first thing. This was complemented by IS declaring the so-called caliphate. So it was only a few days later that IS said, we are a caliphate and our caliph is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So no jihadist group had really done that before.
So caliphate means a state that is going to expand.
Global, exactly. And it has global ambitions and it will not stop. You know, the name, the caliphate. Now, I grew up in Iraq and I've read a lot of, in our history books, the golden days of the caliphate. So for IS, it knew it was really tantalizing because it's linked to Muslim successes, achievement, as well as authority and supremacy. And then you had step three, which I think also was a really powerful factor, is that it launched a really slick and savvy media operation to support steps one and two and to market the caliphate. It sought to appeal to Muslims from all over the world to join and help build this new state.
And I like to get into that marketing or propaganda that you mentioned. Their news agency was called A'maq.
Yes.
How did it operate?
A'maq actually is one of the only lasting media fixtures of IS, so it's still active today. Mm. So during the heyday of the caliphate, mainly I would say between 2014, 2017, IS ran a very sophisticated media operation with a regular flow of high-quality videos, magazines in multiple languages, and it even had a radio station that broadcast on FM waves in Iraq and Syria. It had, of course, the self-styled news agency A'maq. And A'maq, actually, until this day, it has this veneer of professionalism. So if you read the language of A'maq, it's very different from IS's other outlets, where it doesn't use derogatory term for Shia Muslims. Mm. It uses more neutral language.
To appeal to everyone.
Exactly. And it wants to be taken seriously. Now, the videos really highlighted IS's brand of extreme brutality, with constant footage of beheadings and other forms of sadistic killings. But the media was also keen to show the so-called good life on IS territory, because, of course, it was appealing to Muslims to come and live. So the videos, which tried to recruit people, they boasted about IS's healthcare system. I remember one of those videos, the healthcare branding was modeled after the NHS. And they even had British medics and doctors who were originally from Britain who had joined IS. They fronted these videos and talked about free and sophisticated healthcare. And they would go around the hospital and show all the equipment they had.
As the media would like to tell you, things are pretty chaotic here. But what I've come to see here is there's actually a really good medical service being provided here. Lots of hospitals.
Very ironic that they were copying the West, but
exactly. And of course, because these are English-speaking doctors, it also showed the education system with children being indoctrinated. But also they were saying, see, the children are catered for. They have free meals. We provide a full day for them. They flaunted leisure time. So a lot of the videos showed leisure time. So IS families, mostly foreign families, enjoying picnics, lush parks and fairgrounds. Growing up in Iraq, there was a very famous five-star hotel called the Nineveh International Hotel. So when IS captured Mosul, it rebranded it, calling it the Inheritors, meaning we inherited this land and all that's on it. And it made it like a big ad, and it was a celebration. Come and, you know, to this hotel and, you know, spend your time. Imagine going on holiday with the company of IS. They were promoting the good life and really appealing to people from the West. Now, the majority of the people they ruled were actually Iraqis and Syrians, but the majority of the videos showed foreign fighters and foreign people. They knew that with the foreigners, they would make headlines. They wanted to entice others to come. Oh, if this family who's from Britain or from France, if they think it's okay and they're talking about their good life, so maybe it's safe for me to take my family and go. So it was really important for them to focus on the foreign families.
And that was happening. People were leaving. And
They were. And of course, they do talk about later on with the people who did manage to get out. They talk about how they felt duped and how actually things on the ground were very different from how it was obviously portrayed in the propaganda.
And these days, we don't really see much of those videos anymore. How has their media strategy and communication strategy changed?
So when I talk about these videos, IS was very active on Twitter during those days. But as the beheading videos started to come out of Western journalists and of aid workers, Twitter clamped down on IS's operations, and then they moved IS, as well as other jihadist groups, they moved to encrypted messaging apps. However, since its caliphate was crushed on the ground, its media capabilities were significantly degraded. So really gone are the days when IS would have publications and videos in multiple languages. Now, videos from IS are rare. Actually, this year, there was only one propaganda video. It's only in Arabic. So they don't have the language capabilities and the translators. And so increasingly, IS relies heavily on online supporters and media groups, unofficial media groups, to fill that gap, to create content, to provide translations. But of course, I mean, you think about AI, and I think the danger is IS and groups like IS exploiting AI to swiftly translate their messages to various languages really quickly. And we already have seen this happening. One of a key pro-IS media group has created a bulletin, a news bulletin video with an AI presenter, animated AI presenter, reading out IS's news.
حصاد الإخبار. بتوفيق الله تعالى هاجم جنود الخلافة ثكنة للجيش النيجيري المرتد في بلدة.
We already are seeing the potential of them exploiting new technology.
That is worrying.
It is.
That is a very interesting point you made. So in 2019, the caliphate collapsed. And with it, as you said, their media empire, as you would call it, also collapsed. But they exist. Have they morphed into something else? How are they operating? What is going on with IS?
Yes, unfortunately, the group has not gone away. In a nutshell, I think they've morphed from being a group that controls territory, that claims to have institutions, that provides services, into an insurgent group that is on the run, carrying out hit and run attacks, engaged in guerrilla warfare. And they always talk about attrition war to wear down their enemies. And that's how the group operates. After losing their Middle East bases in 2019, IS started to pivot towards Africa, namely sub-Saharan Africa, where it currently has five branches based in Nigeria, the Sahel, DR Congo, Mozambique, and Somalia. And of course, IS is very happy about that because it's always talking about we have a global, far-flung caliphate with branches all over the world. In the last few years, Africa makes up the bulk of IS activity, not the Middle East, but Africa, with 67% of attacks claimed in African countries this year. And IS relies heavily on its Africa branches to project, you know, this idea of ongoing caliphate and endurance and presence.
Back in March this year, there was an attack in Russia, quite a big attack, at the Crocus City Hall. IS claimed it. What do we know about that attack, and why did they target Russia?
So IS has attacked Russia before, but nothing on this scale. IS was very quick to claim responsibility, and it said four of its operatives were involved. Now, in the run-up to the attack, Russia hadn't really featured prominently in IS propaganda. I think it was really an opportunistic attack rather than a change in IS strategy. Prior to the attack, it was relatively easy for Central Asians, to, including Tajiks, to travel and work in Russia. It was actually even encouraged by the Russian authorities, given the war in Ukraine and their need for a working force. course. So IS, and particularly its Afghanistan-focused branch, saw an opportunity to strike in Russia. And the group said, you know, why are people surprised that we would attack Russia? Of course, Russia. Russia is a key enemy of the jihadists. It talked about Russia's military involvement back in the days in Afghanistan and in Chechnya and in more recently and ongoing in Syria. So they said, of course, Russia is a key enemy. And whenever there's an opportunity, we will attack Russia. So the Russia attack was a big propaganda coup for IS. And the group immediately tried to build on that to call for further attacks in Russia, but also in the West.
And Mina, you are a jihadi watcher, as you said. There are obviously IS is not the only group you're monitoring. What other groups are on your radar?
So our patch is very much global. So we're not looking at any region. We're just looking at any place where a violent jihadist group is active. We're not looking very broadly at Islamist groups. We're not looking at, for example, Shia militias. So in addition to IS, we look at the messaging and groups like Al-Qaeda and its various branches. Of course, it has branches in Somalia, Al-Shabaab, in the Sahel. And we monitor the propaganda and online activities of jihadist ideologues and influencers and content creators and how they try to support and promote the jihadist narratives, because they play a crucial role in building this overall kind of us versus them image and trying to incite attacks and to recruit.
So, Mina, when you're monitoring them, what are the things that you look into?
We look at a wide range of things, and it's mostly to understand where is the jihadist threat. What are jihadists trying to achieve? So we look at the official messages, including from the leadership of these groups. We look at the propaganda videos, the posters. We look at big books and essays, and a lot of it's very dense, you know, theological stuff. So you really have to have a good understanding of Arabic, for example, and jihadist literature and, you know, religious literature in general to be able to kind of discern what it is that they're trying to send through these messages. We look at the daily claims of attacks and we do all the alerts and breaking news.
How do you verify? Because these are not exactly the most trustworthy groups.
You have to take it with a pinch of salt. And you have to bear in mind, this is propaganda.
Yeah.
Their work is all misinformation, exactly. Disinformation. So we really differentiate in our work between official messaging and propaganda and unofficial. So unofficial comes from the supporters of a jihadist group. It could be fanboys, really, what they call keyboard jihadists online, pushing out how easy is it to, you know, especially now with AI, to create a poster and threaten a stadium in the West or anywhere. It's very easy to do that. In April, lots of Western media outlets, I would say the majority of media outlets, they went with the line that IS has been inciting attacks against stadiums in the UK, France and Germany in the context of the Euro 24. And this incitement did not come from IS itself. Hmm. Incitement from IS itself would carry different weight. The incitement of the campaign, it came from unofficial accounts from supporters of IS. And so we were very clear to tell the BBC, who was also reporting on the story, to make it clear that this is unofficial. And we put all the caveats that were necessary. So I think we are very careful to provide context, nuance, and all the caveats in our reporting.
This is a documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Farnak Amidi, and in this episode of The Fifth Floor, we are talking to BBC's jihadist media expert, Mina Alami. And Mina, would you say that IS is at the moment probably the most threatening of all of these groups, of these jihadist groups?
I think it's hard to say because IS, for the group, its fortunes fluctuate. Mm. And so do the fortunes of jihadist groups. One day they're up and then another next day they're down. So if we were having this interview last year, I would probably be telling you about IS being in decline, it losing another leadership figure and the kind of the attacks going down and that it was licking its wounds. But this year, things have drastically changed and the group's activity have really surged, unfortunately. We started the year with the Iran attack that killed nearly 100 people, followed by an attack in Istanbul, and then the attack in Russia that killed 145 people. And then, of course, you have IS surging in Syria and in Mozambique, claiming lots of, you know, attacks there. But it's not the only threat. You have Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And in my opinion, actually, it's been a bit underestimated, the threat from Al-Shabaab, because I think Al-Shabaab has control over territory in central and southern Somalia. It claims to be providing services, but it doesn't have the same, I guess, news kind of worthy value of IS. There's also the group Al-Qaeda's branch in the Sahel, which is active in Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger. It is really a menacing group, and it's claiming loads of attacks every month with lots of casualties. Last week, it claimed a big attack in Burkina Faso that killed at least 100 soldiers. And I think the danger with al-Qaeda is that their branches are entrenched within the communities, so they've been there for a long time. And al-Qaeda is very pragmatic, and like IS. IS is in your face. We do this. Mm. We're not going to compromise. We're brutal, and yeah, we know it. With al-Qaeda, it really tries to soften its tone. It really tries to win over people and say, you know, it's fine if you're not really strict Muslims. It's fine. You know, there's room. We're flexible. So I think that's the danger with al-Qaeda. Because it's more pragmatic, it could get into communities more than IS.
And are these groups still putting out recruitment material?
I would say that the majority of jihadist propaganda really is about recruitment. You know, whether they're telling you in your face or through a poster, join us, or whether they're putting out a theological essay, it's really the end result or the end goal is to recruit people mm-hmm. to their cause, whether to recruit them physically to carry out attacks or recruit them to the ideology.
And what about world events? Do they respond to those as well?
I would say jihadists are usually very quick to respond to world events and try to exploit them. For example, there has been a lot of incitement and efforts to recruit in the context of the war in Gaza, and efforts by jihadists to exploit genuine Muslim anger, especially in the West, and redirect that anger from protests and political activism to violent action. Mm. Jihadists have been very happy about the war in Ukraine because they argue that it keeps its enemies, the West on the one hand and Russia on the other, preoccupied with each other and away, they hope, from battling mm-hmm. the jihadists.
Mina, you mentioned that you are Iraqi. Did that have anything to do with you getting into this line of work?
Yeah, I think it did, because I started my work with the United Nations in Baghdad, and that was before the U.S. invasion 2003, during and after. And at the time, you know, I was just reporting. But then my reporting really moved to reporting on security incidents in Iraq, because that was after the invasion. A lot of my reporting was based on my own experience and observations of threat on the ground. I lived in Baghdad. I commuted to work. I was actually in the UN building when al-Qaeda blew it up. Luckily, I was one of the fortunate ones to have left the building earlier that day, so hours before.
What year was that?
That was in 2004. So I really lived that experience in Iraq, and I witnessed the quick rise of jihadists in the country. The competing narratives, I mean, I also come from a Sunni Shia family. The competing narratives, so you heard all of that, you experienced all of that. So when I moved to the UK to do my studies, it kind of felt natural to work in a field that I kind of understood to some extent with, you know, from my own lived experience.
And what's the hardest thing about the job you do? I mean, I can imagine you watch a lot of not so pleasant videos, and you have to read a lot about violence and atrocities.
Yeah, it's all doom and gloom within this field. So my team and I, yes, we do get exposed regularly, daily, I would say, to very graphic content, and it's never easy to examine and report. We're kind of the first point of contact with these videos, and it was a lot harder, of course, during the heyday of IS, because the killing videos were nonstop. And the problem is that we had to kind of verify, okay, so what happened? Did so-and-so actually get killed? Was a child who was involved in that, you know, as an executioner? Did he actually pull the trigger? So you have to kind of constantly go back. So it was really difficult during those days. It's somewhat easier, but I think it's never easy to watch these videos of killings and, you know, beheadings. So that's really difficult. And, you know, you can't help but put yourself in the position of the victims. Of course, you're watching their final yeah. moments in life, and that's really, really difficult, and you're watching their body language. So we do have mechanisms within the BBC to help us cope with such content, and we have monthly sessions to talk through all of this, but it's never easy. And you see, of course, jihadists always using their propaganda, the suffering of Muslims, especially yeah. of civilians and children. So whether it was from the days of IS, you know, with the US-led coalition and the bombings there, or in Gaza now, it's constant. So in your face all the time, the suffering of Muslims you see, especially children, and that's really difficult.
Yeah, it's very close to your heart as well. Like, for instance, when you were talking about that hotel in Mosul, Nineveh, I was thinking, like, when you watch the video, how does it feel to watch, like, you know, this iconic hotel that probably was once filled with music and happy times being shown in that
exactly.
way?
Exactly. It's interesting you mentioned that. for me, you know, in 2014, it was, you know, in the following years, it was really difficult because, of course, as a team, we were reporting on what IS was up to. But for me, this was my country.
Yeah.
You know, it was going through places and areas and I was reading about and reporting on things I knew, I experienced. That's where I grew up. These are my family, my friends. I was contacting friends, actually, who were in the areas that IS took. And I was like, are you okay? Where are you? Are things okay? You know, have you managed to leave? And I remember, actually, not the Nineveh Hotel, but I remember when IS rigged the Assyrian ruins in Mosul. And they just, you could see the militants putting explosives throughout the ruins. And they blew them. You can imagine, these are ruins that are already very fragile. And then you put explosive throughout them. I just couldn't watch. I was so angry. I mean, of course, I mean, people had died. And of course, human lives are more valuable. But I was so upset and angry because I think it was in Iraqi, wow, those, you know, the first civilizations. And I was gutted that I had never actually visited these ruins. I always meant to. I always said, I will go and I will visit because they're amazing. I've always read and, read about them and seen the pictures. And I thought, wow, so they're gone forever. They blew them up. And I remember leaving my desk, not being able to report, just out of anger, just going around the room thinking, how could they do this? There's the finality about it. IS will be pushed out. But that's it. They've killed people. They've blown up ruins. And that's it. It's done.
Mina, you're sitting in front of me and I can see a twinkle in your eye and passion and a fire. There's something about this job that gives you a satisfaction. I can see it.
It could sound contradictory. So I'm really angry about what they're doing. And I talk about the graphic content that's very difficult. But it's a fascinating field to specialize in. You get to dive into the narratives. You join the dots. You examine the visual and linguistic aspects of messaging. You're kind of like an investigator. You know, when I get a video, I'm not just looking, this is what they said. And this is what, you know, what it was called. No, I'm looking at every aspect of it. I'm looking at any nuances, changes in the tone, the branding, the visuals. Oh, this is new. You're informing your readers or your audience is, you know what, this is new. I spotted it. There's never a dull day. So if you have passion for the subject matter and you kind of understand the purpose behind what you're doing, it does help you really survive the, you know, the nasty content that you see.
Mina Alami, BBC's jihadist media specialist. I'm Farhana Khamidi and the Fifth Floor team was Caroline Ferguson and Alice Joya. The sound engineers were Donald McDonald and Duncan Hannant. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.